By the time Brunn got back to base, she had cooled down enough to be icily polite to her security escort. They were icily polite in return. It was long after midnight. She could hear the snarling of the transports picking up teams for the field exercise. The exercise she should have been on. She checked the outbound shuttle and transport schedules. No doubt there would be formalities, but she should be able to get away before Esme came back. She put her name on the list for an appointment with the commandant of schools in the morning and went back to her quarters to get what rest she could. When she went in, it was clear that the commandant already knew something. She could see it in his face, and before she even sat down, he started to apologize.
Sarah Meager, I understand a junior officer acted very inappropriately.
You had a scan on Lieutenant Sweezer.
On you, Sarah Meager. I'm sorry, but for your own safety, we thought that...
It was intolerable. She could not even have a quarrel without someone listening in.
Well, I suppose you got an earful.
Lieutenant Sweezer was totally unprofessional. You have my fleet's apology.
Never mind that. She was rude, yes, but she made it clear I will never be accepted on my own merits. And I am placing an undue burden on your staff, trying to keep me safe. I'm resigning my place, or whatever you call it.
Does your father know?
She could have slugged him, but his question was another proof that she was right.
I am informing him by Ansible transmission this morning, sir. As soon as public hours open, I plan to take fleet transport to the nearest civilian transport nexus.
Brunn could not think of the name.
I will probably lease a vessel from there.
Well, you need not hurry.
I would rather be gone before the field exercise is over.
Brunn was determined not to see Esme Sweeza again. Or Baron Serrano, for that matter. She could just imagine what his grandmother would say.
I see. Again, while I think your decision is probably best under the circumstances, you have my assurance that Lieutenant Sweeza's behavior will not go without official rebuke.
Exhaustion rolled over her suddenly like a heavy blanket. She didn't care about Lieutenant Sweeza. She just wanted to be away from these people with their punctilious rules, their unbending righteousness.
I will cooperate with all necessary procedures.
Brunn pushed herself up. What she really wanted was a week's sleep. She could get that once she left this miserable place. She put on her public persona to get through the remaining hours. She smiled at the right time, shook the right hands, murmured the right pleasantries, assured everyone that she had taken no offense, harbored no grievances, had simply come to the conclusion that this was not right for her. By nightfall, her father had replied to her request that he send his personal militia to replace the Royal Space Service security when she reached civilian space. He had agreed, with what enthusiasm she could not judge, to her plan of spending a few months visiting relatives and business contacts before returning to Cerealis for the opening of the hunting season. At local midnight, she boarded the shuttle off-planet and hoped that Esme Sweeza was having a miserable time wherever she was. 30 hours into the field exercise, Esme wondered why she had ever thought this was a good idea for an elective. She had led her team safely through the first third of the course. They had spotted and evaded a number of traps. But they were hungry, thirsty, and tired now, and she was fresh out of ideas. Ahead lay grassland to the line of fence that represented safety. They hadn't been spotted in the broken ground, but out there they couldn't hide. And it was too great a distance to cross in a rush. If they stayed where they were, they'd probably be found. And anyway, they wouldn't get the extra points for getting to the safe hold.
A tunnel would be handy. I don't suppose we could find an animal burrow.
I doubt it.
Briefing had said the native animals were all under 5 kilos. Of course, Briefing had left a lot out. Esme held them all where they were until dusk. Then they began a slow, careful crawl through the grass toward the fence line. The hood cut off sight instantly. She struck out uselessly, knowing it was useless. Her blows fell on air, but the blows aimed at her landed, knocked her sideways, back, sideways again, until she finally fell, her head slamming into a hummock she had not been able to see. She tasted blood. She'd bitten her tongue in that fall. Before she could react, the assailants grabbed arms and legs and in seconds, she was immobilized like a calf for branding.
Was it like this for Baron?
No, for him it had been real. But the pain was real now, too. A fist grabbed her hair through the hood and yanked her head back.
Think of something else. It does help, but you don't believe it at the time.
That was in the manual, too, so others had found it useful. As she felt rough hands on the fastening of her clothes and the cold edge of a blade, and then the tug as her clothes were cut away, her mind slid back toward that other time in childhood.
No.
She would not go there. She would think of something that made her feel strong. What came into her head was the argument with Brunn. In her head, in this pain-filled dark, she could think of much more to say than she had said. As the hours passed, hours she could not count, she elaborated on the argument and its causes all the way back to that first meeting with Brunn and imagined herself and Brunn and Baron, what each said, what each was thinking, what each thought the other was thinking. The verbal assaults of her captors became the things Brunn had said, or would have said if she'd thought of them. The blows they dealt were the blows Brunn would have dealt if she had dared fight openly. But in the story she was telling herself, she gave as good as she got. Better, in fact. For Brunn's attacks, she now had the right counterattacks. For Brunn's invincible arrogance, she now had a response that brought Brunn to her knees, that forced her to acknowledge Esme's position, skills, knowledge. In her mind, at least, she could triumph. She was vaguely conscious that her captors were considerably annoyed with her for some reason, but nothing mattered as much as Brunn's appropriation of Baron and her own determination to defend, not territory exactly, but her chance at... As suddenly as it began, it ended. She didn't notice at first, though as she came back to real space and time, she was aware that her mind had noticed and had begun pulling her back from the story she'd been writing in her mind. She felt the cool, blunt snout of a hypo spray against her arm, then a wave of returning clarity. When she opened her eyes, a medic smiled at her and gave the code phrase that meant the exercise was over. And Lieutenant Commander Euless, looking no grimmer than usual, reached out a hand to help her up.
Sweeza, you're tougher than I thought. Whatever you were doing inside your head worked. Keep it in mind, in case you need it.
Esme felt shaky when she stood, and only then noticed that her hands were bandaged. He nodded at them.
You'll need an hour or so in the regen tank. The team kept thinking they could get to you in just another little bit, but it's all within regs.
Now she could feel the pain working its way past the restorative drug. Euless put out his arm again.
Better take hold. We'll get you into the transport. You're the last here.
The team?
You all passed. Even Taris. I don't know how you got her through it, but you did.
She did.
Esme felt distinctly odd with the combination of stimulant and residual imagination, but managed not to throw up or fall down. Once in the transport, she tried to let herself relax, but she couldn't quite.
It could still be a trick. It could still be.
She woke briefly back at the base when the medics were easing her into the regen tank. One glimpse of her hands was enough. She didn't fight the sedative they gave her, but slid into unconsciousness. By the time Esme got back to her quarters, she was more than ready for solitude and sleep. The pain was gone, and there were no visible bruises, but her body insisted that something traumatic had happened. The medics said she'd feel much better in the morning. That tank healing often left people feeling slightly disoriented and peculiar. She decided not to bother with undressing. Esme wasn't sure if minutes or hours had passed when the comm unit chimed.
The Commandant wishes to see you at your earliest convenience. He will expect you within 10 minutes.
She tried to shake herself awake and finally staggered toward the shower.
What can the Commandant possibly want?
The Commandant did not look as if this were just an administrative matter. Esme came to attention and waited.
I understand you had an disagreement with the Speaker's daughter, Brunn Meager.
As if she didn't know who it was, as if she did not know with whom she had quarreled.
Yes, sir.
The surveillance recordings indicated that you criticized Sarah Meager on grounds of her moral failings.
Certain phrases came back to her memory for the first time in days, as if highlighted in flame.
Sir.
Do you really think that was appropriate professional demeanor, Lieutenant?
If you have the tapes, you know why I said what I said.
Esme wished she'd been more tactful, but it was petty of Brunn to have reported their argument.
Let me put it another way, Lieutenant. Whatever the provocation, do you think it is appropriate for a fleet officer to lecture a civilian, a prominent civilian, as if they were rival fishwives? Because, Lieutenant, I can tell you that I do not consider it appropriate. I consider it an embarrassment, and I'm quite seriously disappointed in your performance. Allowances have been made for your background.
Esme stirred, but he held up a warning hand and went on.
Your background, as I said, would be some excuse if you were not from a prominent family on Altiplano, and if you had not previously commented on the greater formality of manners there. I hardly think you would have spoken to a civilian guest of your father's in such terms as you used to Sarah Meager.
No, sir.
She wouldn't, because no young woman of family would have behaved like Brunn Meager. She tried to think of an equivalent crime and couldn't. But no use explaining. That never did any good.
And then to make comments when someone in the media could hear you.
Sir?
Don't tell me you don't know about that.
Sir, after the argument with Brunn, I finished packing and then left on the field exercise. I didn't talk to anyone else about anything at all. I didn't talk to anyone about her during the exercise, and I just got back from medical. I'm sorry, sir, but I don't know what you're talking about.
He looked slightly taken aback, someone in a righteous rage who had stumbled over an inconvenient contrary fact.
You spoke to no one?
No one, sir.
Well, you must have been loud enough for someone to overhear, because it certainly made the news.
There would have been no media on a military installation on Altiplano. It wasn't fair to blame her because they'd let media follow Brunn around and poke into every cranny.
You, of all people, should know that Fleet is under great suspicion at this time, between the mutinies and the Lipescu affair, and the last thing we need is some wild-eyed young officer accusing the Speaker's daughter of immorality. That does us no good with the Grand Council, or for that matter, with the populace at large. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
I wonder. You are an intelligent officer, and supposedly talented in tactics, but in all my years, I don't think I've ever seen as egregious an example of bad judgment. You've embarrassed me, and you've embarrassed the regular space service. If you didn't have such a good record previously, I would seriously consider having you up for conduct unbecoming an officer.
All she had done was tell a rich, spoiled brat the plain truth. But clearly, some unpleasant truths were not to be told. Brunn was the one who had done wrong, and now Esme was in trouble. Her head was pounding again.
Let me tell you what you're going to do, Lieutenant. You are going to avoid any interviews on any topic whatsoever. You are going to make no comments whatever about Sarah Meager to anyone. If asked, you will say you lost your temper, which clearly is the case, and you have no more to say. I would have you apologize to Sarah Meager, except that she chose to leave this facility, and no wonder. And I doubt she wants to hear from you anyway. Is all that clear?
Yes, sir.
Dismissed.
Esme saluted and withdrew, angry with both herself and Brunn. She shouldn't have said what she said. All right, she could admit she'd been too angry to think straight. But Brunn had taken advantage of her time and again, and to go complain to authority was another proof of her childishness. Esme was supposed to meet Baron. He'd left word on her comm unit, but she really wanted to crawl into her bunk and sleep another 12 hours. At least, she thought, he wouldn't waste their time talking about Brunn. Brunn was the first topic he brought up, after mentioning that he'd seen the newsflash along with everyone else in the class.
You were pretty hard on her. She's not as bad as all that.
She is.
It was too much. Esme was not going to let Brunn get away with ruining this, too. She saw his face change, his expression harden against her. Sorrow cut through her, but her anger pushed her on, forcing her against the blade of his disapproval.
She had no right to come after you. If she had one scrap of morality...
That's not fair. She does. It's just that that someone like that...
The richest girl in the Familius Regnant? The rules are different for the rich, is that what you're saying?
No, yes, but not the way you mean it.
The way I mean is that people who have her advantages ought to have used them for something more than personal pleasure.
Well, had you told her that we were anything to each other?
No, I did not. It was none of her business. It has nothing to do with me and you. It has to do with her assumption that anyone she wants should climb in bed with her.
Anyone? She didn't try to get you?
Esme shook her head, which was beginning to throb in the old way.
No, she didn't. Of course she didn't. It's just that she went after you, and you're an officer of Fleet, and younger than she is.
Too late, she remembered that she herself could not be simultaneously older than Brunn and co-equal with Baron.
It was unseemly, chasing junior officers.
Baron reached out, but drew back his hand before touching her.
Esme, please. It was perfectly natural, and all she did was ask. When I said no, she didn't bother me. Perfectly polite, perfectly within the boundaries of courtesy.
You said no?
Of course I said no. What do you think? You thought I slept with her? How could you think that?
Esme could say nothing. Baron, glaring at her, nodded sharply, as if her silence confirmed some dire suspicion.
You thought I did. You thought just because I shared a few meals with her while you were busy, just because we talked, just because she's a rich girl, that I'd leap into her bed like a trained puppy. Well, I'm no one's pet, Esme. Not hers and not yours. If you really cared for me, you'd know that. I'm sorry you understand so little, but if you want to succeed in Fleet, you better get off your moral high horse and start dealing with reality.
He was gone before she could say anything, and long before anyone could have suspected what she had once worried they might suspect. She made it to her quarters at last and spent another night not sleeping, staring at the ceiling over her bunk. When they met in class the next day, Esme could do nothing but stare miserably at the back of Baron's head. He did not turn to look at her. When called on, he gave his answers in his familiar, crisp voice. She found that she could do the same, though she wasn't at all sure how her brain could keep working when her heart was lying in a sodden heap somewhere below her navel. To her surprise, she received a high score on her field exercise. It did not make her feel better, though her subdued acceptance of the certificate seemed to please Lieutenant Commander Euless. She could feel the subtle withdrawal of her classmates, even those like Vericourt, who had been friendly all along. Anonymity had been a lot easier than disgrace. On the day Baron was due to leave, she made her way to the exit area. She felt she had to make some contact with him, or she might as well jump off a tower. Her hands were icy. She could feel her heart pounding as she spotted him across the room.
Baron.
Lieutenant.
Baron, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to insult you.
No apologies necessary.
She thought she saw a bit of warmth in his eye, but nothing more. He wasn't going to reach out to her, not here in public, and he showed no signs of wanting a more private conversation.
I just don't want us to be enemies.
Never. Never enemies, Lieutenant, even if we can't agree.
A long pause during which Esme heard what he did not say aloud, or what she imagined he was saying. She didn't know which.
Goodbye, Lieutenant. And good luck on your first assignment in command track. You'll do fine.
Thank you. And good luck to you.
Esme's throat closed on the rest of what she wanted to say.
We could stay in touch. We could plan.
She had ruined what they had, and that was it. They shook hands, formally, and then saluted, formally, and then he moved over to the line forming for his shuttle. Esme did not wait to see if he would turn around and wave. She was sure he wouldn't. Esme had not been outside the gates of the facility before, but now she found herself wandering out to Q-Town, in the kind of numb misery she thought she'd never feel again. She didn't want to see anyone from her class in the mess hall, but she had to eat before leaving or she'd throw up. Someone had said, who was it? She couldn't recall someone on Kosciusko, that while she was on Copper Mountain, she'd have to visit Diamond Sims. She spotted the sign down the street and made for it. The man in the hover chair gestured to her almost as soon as she cleared the door.
Lieutenant Sweezer, I'm glad you came. I'm Sam. I run this place.
Someone was glad to see her? She glanced around, recognizing with a strange shock what this bar was about, and made her way toward the back.
We're honored you came by. Major Patak said you might if you had time.
Sorry it took me so long. I was doubling courses.
Oh, yeah, well, we keep track of people at the school, so I knew you were busy. Didn't expect you before now, and didn't know if you'd have time. When's your shuttle?
Esme took the seat he indicated.
About 5 hours.
You in trouble about that meager woman?
Brunn again. Esme managed a nod and hoped that would indicate she didn't want to talk about it.
It's partly my fault. She came in here hopping mad that night and shut off her mouth in front of the whole room. We think what happened is that one of the newsies on her tail got it with a spike mic from out on the street. At least nobody that was here will admit to telling it.
It's not worth worrying about. It happened. I can't change it now.
You sound like someone who needs a steak.
The man raised his hand, and a waitress appeared. He glanced at Esme.
Steak all right? Onions?
No onions, thanks.
Not with a shuttle lift off. But she nodded to the rest of his suggestions, and soon the sizzling platter appeared. She started eating.
Yeah, she's a pretty thing, but stubborn as a stump. Good argument against letting civilians train at our facilities, no matter whose children they are. It does no good to mix with the families. They employ us. They cannot be us.
For some reason, perhaps the energy imparted by the steak, Esme was moved to argue.
She had a lot of talents we could use.
Oh, certainly, if she had any discipline at all.
She did pull off some good stuff I heard about. Helping that old lady, she worked hard on that.
You'd make a silk purse out of any sow's ear, would you, Lieutenant? Good attitude for a young officer, but you'll find some of them smell a pig no matter what you do. So, where are you going now?
I'm not sure. They're supposed to have my assignment ready by the time I get to Sector HQ. They may bury me in paperwork.
No, I don't think so. Even if you're in trouble now, it'll pass. And they're not going to waste a young officer with real combat ability.
The Admiral looked down the length of the conference room.
We're going to have to find something else. I know what we thought we were going to do with Lieutenant Sweezer, but we certainly cannot reward her performance with a plum assignment.
We needed her the way she was.
The way we thought she was, Commander. Thank any deity you like that we brought her in for training before assigning her permanently to Command Track. Imagine the mess she could have caused as a cruiser captain if all this had slid by.
I still find it hard to understand. There was nothing, nothing in her record to indicate that kind of character flaw. Rather, the opposite.
There was nothing in her record to indicate her ability in combat till Xavier. If she could hide that kind of talent, and she did, then this is no more difficult. And after all, she'd never been in contact with any of the families before. Altiplano has no seat in council.
There is that. I wish we knew whether there was anything more to it.
More? Verbal assault on the Speaker's daughter isn't enough?
Well, is it just personal or is it political? Is she the spear point for something?
I don't know, and at the moment, I don't care. We've wasted entirely too much money and time on this young woman, and we're going to have to figure out a way to get repaid without risking the welfare of the fleet.
The Admiral looked around the table.
Someone had better have an idea how.
Down at the far end, a Lieutenant Commander raised her hand.
Sir, she's elected to take both the basic level search and rescue as well as escape and evasion, right?
Yes.
SAR is chronically short of junior officers for both ship XOs and SAR team leaders, and those are command track billets. There are at least 3 openings for lieutenants in Sector 7 alone.
Relatively small ships, elite crew, operating independently for the most part. Yes, she'd be under close supervision. If she messes up or tries to foment some kind of action, her captain would know for sure. Good. What have you got?
Shrike, I thought. Podali Solis is commanding it, and his exec just applied for family leave.
I don't know about having her second in command.
My thought was it puts her more directly under the captain's supervision than she would be as a team leader. And we have no doubts about Solis. He helped us clean out that mess at Sector HQ, as I'm sure the Admiral recalls.
Yes, that's true. Probably the best we can do. Bless the girl. Why couldn't she have been as good as she seemed?
Esme arrived at Shrike's dock area to find it in perfect order. The guard saluted crisply and checked her orders.
I'll just let the captain know. We didn't expect you until early next shift.
Gossamer came in early.
Esme wondered what her father would think now, both about her promotion and the trouble she was in. She was sure he'd followed her career as best he could from Altiplano. Her promotions and awards were matters of public record, and the news media had covered the Kosciusko affair. Her thoughts drifted to her great-grandmother, so fragile, so embedded in her culture's past. What would she think? For an instant, she wished she could sit beside that low chair and pour out the whole story. Surely her great-grandmother would understand about Baron. Surely she would feel the same way about Brunn. Esme did not know whether Captain Solis's reserve was his habitual mood or whether he had been informed of the trouble she was in.
You're quite an experience to be taking over as number two. I understand you have a distinguished combat record, especially considering that you were not in command track at the time. But the executive officer of an SAR, it's asking rather a lot of you.
I'll do my best, sir.
I'm sure you will. Your experience on a DSR will be some use, and I see you stood well in your classes in both search and rescue and escape and evasion. Still, it will be a stretch, and you might as well be prepared. Now, about this other problem. Your quarrel with the Speaker's daughter. If I'd been your CO, I'd have had you up for conduct unbecoming. He didn't. And so far, you have no record here, but I warn you, I will not tolerate disrespect for the civil government of the Familias Regnant. Officers do not play politics. We serve. We do not interfere.
Esme wanted to say that Brunn was not her father and had no official position of her own, but she knew she must not. Why did they keep thinking that her opinion of Brunn's behavior had anything to do with her loyalty to the fleet?
Yes, sir.
You will find no support for any family games on my ship, and no room for grandstanding either. You do your job and do it well, and you'll get the appropriate credit in your fitness reports. Nothing more, nothing less.
Yes, sir.
I'll expect you back here in 2 hours for a briefing. Dismissed.
It was cold comfort that her duffel was all in her compartment when she got there. At least her new position ensured a compartment, even on so small a ship. She glanced around. Bunk, storage lockers, desk, cube reader, and, to her surprise, a row of display screens above the desk. Esme inserted her data wand into the slot, and these screens flashed to life. One displayed the orders of the day, another gave the status of the two SAR teams and their vehicles, yet another listed stores, cross-linked to consumption rates. Esme stowed her gear in the lockers. She had nothing to put in two of them, and changed into a clean uniform. She did not look forward to the next meeting with her captain.
I hate losing Colin, but his wife was killed in a traffic accident while she was downside, arranging for their children to change fosterage. It's going to take him quite a while to sort everything out. You'll find we have good teams, Lieutenant, and a tour on an SAR is always interesting. We deal with problems that the big boys ignore. Everything from private yachts stranded by jump drive blowouts to collisions. You will learn a lot. And since we didn't expect you until tomorrow, you're not on the watch list yet, which gives you time to poke around and start learning your job.
All I've had was the basic SAR course, sir. They assigned me before I had time for the advanced.
Better than nothing. And if you know you don't know, you'll ask questions instead of blundering around causing trouble. Now, the duties of exec on this ship are different than on line ships. That's because our mission is different. There's the basic stuff, of course. But I'd like you to look at this.
He handed over a data cube.
And of course, you'll want to meet everyone. We'd planned a get-together this evening at 1900.
That's fine, sir. I can get unpacked and have a chance to look this over. Unless you have something now.
No, that's fine. We're not kicking out of here until day after tomorrow anyway. There's a meeting tomorrow, which you'll have to attend as my representative. You haven't been with the ship quite long enough to take over full prep.
Alone in her cabin, her name was already on the door, she noticed, with the permanent engraving Executive Officer underneath. She inserted the cube the captain had given her into the reader. She knew what an exec did, or thought she did. Run the ship, basically, under the captain's command. But on a search and rescue ship, the exec also had the responsibility of supervising all rescue efforts, while the captain concentrated on ship security, of both this ship and the rescued one. She blinked at the listing for the security detachments. She had not realized that an SAR ship would carry Marines, though it made sense. Most of the time, when the ships needed rescue, it was the result of some deliberate act, and the troublemakers might still be in the area. And she'd had only the basic course. So it was definitely going to be a case of Sergeant put up that flagpole if they had a rescue call before she had learned the rest of the stuff she needed, which meant she had better make friends with the sergeant equivalents. She scrolled quickly through the headings of her job description to the ship's table of organization and began to figure out who would do the actual work while she supervised. Shrike mounted two complete rescue teams, cross-trained in both gravity field and zero-gravity work. Like most of the smaller SARs, the gravity field training specialized in low-pressure and vacuum work. Most of their calls would be to space stations or ships in deep space. A forensic team and a lab full of analytical gear suggested that SAR might include something more than accident assistance. And the medical support team was substantially larger than a ship this size normally carried, including both major trauma regen tanks and two surgical theaters, with all that implied. Again, it reminded her of a miniature of Kosciusko. Rescue 1 was commanded by a lieutenant she remembered from the academy as a clown of sorts, Tika Briados. He didn't seem clownish now, as he led her around the ready room with its racked suits and equipment. It all seemed a jumble to Esme, though an orderly one. She recognized only about half the equipment and wondered how long it would take to learn the rest. Rescue 2's commander was a Jig she'd never met before, Kim Arik. She was eager and energetic, busily explaining things that Esme hoped she could remember. She kept nodding and found herself liking Jig Arik for her single-minded enthusiasm. Going through both rescue team areas had taken hours, she found when she finally got away from Arik, and she needed to get ready for the meeting with the other officers. She did hope they weren't all going to mention Brun Meager. The wardroom was crowded when she got there. The blocky major who thrust out his hand reminded her of Major Patak.
Lieutenant Sweeza, glad to meet you. I'm Gordon Bannon, pathology.
Captain Solis stood.
Officers, this is Lieutenant Esme Sweeza, our new executive officer. Some of you have heard of her. She's fresh out of Copper Mountain with the basic course in SAR, so I'm sure you'll all cooperate in educating her about the real world.
After that, the others came up one by one to introduce themselves. Esme began to relax as she chatted with them. They were clearly more interested in how she might perform here than in anything which had happened in her past. In the next few days, Esme threw herself into her work, loading her scheduler with everything she could think of, or that anyone suggested. When Shrike left the base, she was just beginning to think she had a handle on her assignments. Shrike would patrol alone through the sector, ready to assist in any emergency that fell within its mission statement. According to those who had been aboard longest, days might go by with nothing happening, or disasters might overlap. There was no way to predict.
The ship's a part container, part bulk hauler that lost power on insertion. The in-system drive's functioning at maybe 20%. They say it's fluctuating and they can't make orbit. We've advised them that there's a registered salvage company in this system. The captain sounds unhappy with that. Says he's had trouble before with salvage companies.
The first emergency since she'd come aboard. Esme listened to the précis of the problem and tried to remember which protocol this fell under.
He wants fleet assistance. We have a responsibility in such cases, but we must also consider our responsibility to the whole area. So I want an estimate on the time it will take us to skip jump over there, rig grapples and put him in tow, then sling him back toward the orbit he wants. He's not an emergency.
Esme ran the numbers quickly.
Sir, 60 hours, allowing a safety margin for rigging the grapples. He should have standard tug connections, but just in case.
Well then, let's go catch us a freighter.
Esme watched the approach plots carefully on the bridge displays. External vid showed a bulbous, almost spherical ship with rings of colored light indicating tug grapple connections. Lieutenant Briados, the Rescue 1 commander, was on the bridge to watch the approach.
Ugly, isn't it? You'd think they could design big freighters with some character, but they all look pretty much alike.
It would hold a lot of soldiers.
can tell you're off a warship. Yeah, it could, but it hasn't got in-system maneuverability worth spit, even with the in-system drive working.
All right, Sweeza, let's see how you handle this. Just pretend you've been doing it for years.
Her stomach churned. She nodded to the comm watch and picked up the headset to talk to the freighter captain, explaining that a team would be boarding.
We just wanted a tow. I don't see why you want to board.
It's RSS policy to board all vessels seeking assistance. Just routine, sir.
Damn nuisance.
Think of it as practice. If we didn't practice close hauling and boarding, we might not be quick enough for someone with a serious emergency. After all, it might be your ship.
Oh, all right. Just as long as you're not planning to practice cutting holes in my hull.
Shrike deployed standard tug grapples, backed up by its military-grade tractor. In this instance, the grapples homed neatly on the freighter's signal and locked on as Shrike maintained matching course and velocity. The tractor snugged the SAR ship closer still. Esme gave the orders that sent Jig Arik and her team across a few hundred meters of vacuum to the other ship. Rescue 2 made its way in and out of the holds, while Shrike boosted the freighter gently on its way, then returned before Solas ordered the grapples retracted.
Captain, what were they looking for?
Just practicing.
She looked at him. Finally, he grinned at her.
All right, you might as well know. Sector's concerned about possible shortages in the munitions inventory. We think some stuff's being diverted from fleet to civilian use. So the Admiral says to check every ship that asks us for a boost. It is good practice, including the use of the warhead detection equipment.
What's missing?
I've been told I don't need to know, but since they specified the equipment we were to use looking for it, I'd say someone's misplaced some of the more effective nukes.
Ouch.
Exactly. If our stuff's being transshipped on civilian freighters, it could be going anywhere, to anyone. Probably not the Benignity. They have their own munitions industry and plenty in stock. But any of the lesser hostile powers or domestic malcontents...
Or simply pirates.
Yes. Anyone who wants a big bang.
The freighter Elias Madero, owned by the Boros Consortium, followed a five-angled route that had proved lucrative for decades. Olives and wine from Bazaar, jewels mined on Oddlink, livestock embryos from Gollum, commercial-grade organics from Podge, entertainment cubes from Corian, which had FTL traffic from deeper in-system, and the largest population in the area. She was a container hauler, picking up at each port the hold-shaped containers that had been filling since her last visit there. Her crew, most of them permanent, often had no idea what was in the containers. The captain did, presumably, and also the Boros agents at each port. But the containers had no accessible hatches. One advantage of container ships was supposed to be the impossibility of petty pilfering by crews, so they had no idea that the container in hold 5, which was supposed to be filled with 5,832 cube players, was actually full of arms stolen from a fleet stockpile. The other containers in hold 5, which should have had entertainment cubes to be played in the cube players, contained more illicit weaponry, including 34 Witsock 43B11 warheads, their controlling electronics, and the arming keys. Boros' agent at Bazaar would not have been happy to find the contents of that container, since she had a contract to supply the cube players and the entertainment cubes supposedly filling the rest of Hold 5. Elias Madero came out of FTL flight, retranslating to normal space, to traverse the real space distance between two jump points in the same system, colloquially known as two-bits. This shortcut had been marked questionable on standard charts for years, because the presence of two jump points in the same system was believed, on theoretical grounds, to lead to spatial instability of the jump points. If the insertion point shifted, an inbound ship might find itself emerging too close to a large mass, with no time to maneuver clear. But the nearest green-lined route meant three more jump point calculations and added 11 days to the Corian Bazaar passage. Since jump point temporal coordinates were fuzzy anyway, many commercial haulers used shortcuts to ensure that they met contractual delivery dates, while filing flight plans that were all green-lined. This crew had made the traverse before many times without incident. The jump points had not shifted in the past 50 years, while the possibility that they might kept the system uncrowded. On this trip, system insertion went as smoothly as usual, and the Elias transferred to in-system drive without a hitch. Captain Lund turned to his navigation officer, a transfer from Sorius Madero, a sister ship, and clapped a hand on the man's shoulder.
That's done, then. 4 days and we'll be out of here again. I'm going to bed.
Custom and regulation both required that a captain be on the bridge during jump point insertions. Lund had been up 3 shifts running because of a minor engineering problem.
I have the course laid, sir. By my calculations, 97.2 hours.
Very good.
Captain Lund, balding and stocky, waited until he was in his cabin to take off his jacket and kick off his shoes. He hung the jacket up neatly, set his shoes side by side, laid his trousers neatly folded over the back of his chair, with his shirt over them. This was his last cycle. When he reached Corian again, he would retire at last. Helen, his grandchildren, the neat little house set high on a slope above the valley. He drifted into sleep, a smile on his face.
Oh. Captain here, what is it?
Raiders, sir.
Lund sat up, ducking automatically from the overhanging cabinets.
I'm on my way.
From the bridge, the situation was clear. 2 of them, their weapons systems lighting up the scan board with red threats. On the comm screen was a hard-faced man in a uniform he didn't recognize.
You surrender your ship and we'll let the crew off in your lifeboats.
Captain Lund almost choked. Lifeboats would be practically useless in a lifeless system that no one visited because of the paired jump points.
Where's your captain? I want to talk to him.
Lund stepped up to the comm unit and nodded to his exec, who stepped back.
This is Captain Lund. Who are you and what the hell do you think you're doing?
The man favored him with a tight grin that did not look at all friendly.
Taking your ship, sir, in the name of Sacred Liberty and the New Tex Militia. We apologize for any inconvenience.
You're pirates. You have no right.
Them's harsh words, sir. We don't like disrespect for our beliefs. Let me put it this way. We have the weapons to blow your ship away, and we're offering you a chance to save your crew's lives. Some of them, anyway. If you surrender your ship and allow us to board without resistance, we will swear not to kill any of your legal crew.
Legal crew?
Well, yes. We're aware, you see, that you work for a corporation with obscene and unnatural views about moral issues. In our books, there's things that just ain't natural and normal, let alone right. And if you have people like that on board, then they'll have to face justice.
Lund glanced around. The faces on the bridge were tense and pale. He thumbed the comm control to prevent his words going out in transmission.
Do any of you have the slightest idea who these crazies are? Or what they mean about natural and unnatural?
The junior scan tech, Innis Sequelin, nodded.
I've heard a little about the New Tex Militia. For one thing, they think it's wrong for women to be spacers. And for another, they don't tolerate anything but what they call normal sex.
Lund felt his stomach churn. If they didn't allow women in space, what kind of sex did they think was normal? And why not allow women in space?
Is it something religious?
Yes, sir. At least they say it is.
Lund felt even sicker. Religious nuts. He had gone to space to get away from them, back on his home world. If these were the same sort, he had too many crew at risk.
I'm warning you. Answer, or we'll blow your holds.
All right. I'll send my people to the lifeboats.
Oh, we want to see a crew list right now, before you can doctor it up. If a lifeboat separates before we've approved the list, we'll blow it.
Lund's mind raced into high gear. The crew list did not mention gender, and certainly not sexual preferences, so if he could just keep the medical records out of their hands...
And the medical records, in case you got some of them so-called modern women that don't have good women's names?
He could refuse, but then what? According to scan, he was facing weapons easily capable of blowing his ship. But they wouldn't want to blow his ship. They would want the cargo, and perhaps the ship itself, intact.
Personnel and medical records aren't networked.
Lund thanked whatever gods were around, including those he didn't believe in, for the fact that this was standard and known to be standard.
10 minutes.
What doctoring could he do in 10 minutes? And why hadn't he denied the presence of women right away, so that he might have had a chance to pass them off as men? But the ship's tiny medical staff had been listening, and Hansen buzzed up.
I'm changing the genders and stripping out all reference to gender-specific medications. 6 minutes for that. What else do you think?
Sekwon says they have some weird beliefs about sexual practice, but I don't know which.
If they go to space in single-gender ships, maybe they have obligatory homosexuality in space? I could code everyone as male-male preference.
Yeah, but if we're wrong, I don't know.
And what about the children?
Elias Madero, like most commercial ships, carried some of its crew's children aboard. Children had been found well worth the extra work and worry in terms of keeping a crew entertained and cooperative. Right now, there were 6, 4 under school age, and 2 taking a work-study tour as junior apprentices.
We put the kids in the core, where the scans are least likely to find them. Sedate the littles. If they just rob the ship and go on, the older ones can come back out and then send a message. Gotta clear out the nursery, though.
Do it. But don't code gender preference. Just leave it.
How was he going to hide the women? And what would happen to them if they were found? Hazel Takaris, age 16, had found her first working trip to be as dull as her father had warned. But she wouldn't have missed it for anything. Certainly not another 5 terms at the Space Dependence Middle School on Odd-Link Main Station. So she had willingly performed the routine chores allotted to the apprentices, reminding herself, when enthusiasm for washing dishes or scrubbing the deck flagged, that she could have been listening to Professor Hallis discourse on the history of a planet that lay, to Hazel's mind, in the dim past of human history. A long way away and very far back, and who really cared which millennium had produced which oddly named king or scientist. She was doing inventory of the galley stores as ordered by the cook. She heard nothing of the ensuing discussion because Cookie had told her to get back to work and be sure her count was right.
38 3-kilo sacks of wheat flour, 6 half-kilo boxes of sodium chloride salt, and 4 of a 50-50 mix of potassium and sodium chlorides. 8...
Hey, drop that and listen up. Get 4 emergency ration kits and go to Core 32. Hop it!
Cookie's face was an odd shade, the rich tan paled and splotchy.
What?
But apprentices didn't ask questions, not when a crew member looked like that. Hazel grabbed 4 emergency kits, and as she went past, Cookie dumped 2 more on top of them. She scurried as fast as she could through the corridors, turned into the drop to the core, and met her dad, who was even paler than Cookie.
Hayes, give me 2 of those. Now go to 32. We're going to lock you in. I put your suit in there already. Put it on and wait. Be sure you wait long enough.
Hazel had grown up a spacer's child. She could figure it out.
Raiders!
Yeah. Now listen, you and Stinky will be awake. We've sedated the littles, and they'll be in Core 57 and 62. Oh, and remember, it's the New Tex Militia. Go on now!
Hazel fell down the drop, landing easily, feet first, on the pad. 32 was clockwise 4. She had known the geography of this ship from early childhood. 32's hatch was open. She slid in, dumped her rations, pulled the hatch shut, and locked it from inside. Her suit stood slumped in one corner, along with a stack of extra oxygen tanks. She got herself into it, her fingers shaking, fumbling at the catches and seals. Hazel started to report herself secure on suitcom and then didn't. The Raiders could already be aboard. No one had told her when to expect boarding. No one had told her when to come out.
Wait long enough? How long's that? How am I supposed to know?
In her suit, she could not quite lie down in the compartment, but she propped herself corner to corner so that if she fell asleep, she would not fall and make a noise. She had the helmet open to ambient air. No sense in wasting suit air yet, and the helmet would snap shut automatically at any drop in pressure. She looked at her suit chrono and marked the time. Wait long enough. She wished she knew how long. She wished she and Stinky had been in the same compartment so they could talk. As the 2 apprentices, they had formed a natural alliance. Besides that, they liked each other's parents, and had spent the voyage trying to maneuver her father and his mother into some kind of arrangement. So far, the adults had been resistant, but she and Stinky hadn't given up hope. Surely everyone felt the same urge to partner that she and Stinky felt. That's how adults came together to have children, after all. Locked in the empty compartment, it finally occurred to Hazel that the straightforward solution wouldn't have been for her and Stinky to partner and leave the parents alone. But she wasn't ready to partner anyone. Not yet. Later. She allowed herself a few delicious minutes of imagining what it would be like if Stinky were in the same compartment, without the pressure suits or the adult supervision. She had thought like that, even though she had chosen to take the treatment to delay puberty. She might look only 10 or 11, but she was 16 for true. She pulled her mind away from that to the littles, locked away in other compartments. Sedated, her dad said.
How long will sedation last? Brandolin's always first up in the morning, bouncing around. Will she come out of sedation first? Did they put her in the same compartment as her sister?
Surely they'd thought of that. Stassi was quieter and very attached to her big sister. The other two littles, Paolo and Driss, were cousins. She looked at the chrono. Only 15 minutes had passed. That couldn't be long enough. The raiders might not have boarded yet. She might have to wait hours. Her suit transmitted nonspecific vibrations that she could not identify, except that they were different from those she knew so well after all these months aboard. 1 hour, two, three.
How long do raiders stay aboard a ship to plunder it?
Docked at a regular cargo station, the automated handlers could unload a hold in 7 hours and 12 minutes, if nothing went wrong.
Will the raiders try to unload an entire hold? All the holds? Do they have the right equipment? How long will it take them?
It would be easier to steal the whole ship. She felt cold as she thought of it.
If they take the entire ship, then what'll happen to me? To Stinky? To the littles?
The raiders had to be close, because no one had unlocked her compartment yet. The shriek stiffened her. Brandy, that would be. They had all joked that she had a scream that would slice steel plates. Hazel clambered up, clumsy in the suit, and tried to unlock the hatch. She had to stop them. She had to protect the child. She had the lock undone when the hatch was yanked out of her grip, and two big men grabbed her, one for each arm, and pulled her out of the compartment. Hazel could see Brandy kicking in the grip of another, who was trying to gag her with a length of cloth. Stassi was crying, more quietly, in the grip of another. The two little boys clung to Stinky, who looked as scared as she felt.
A girl, perverts.
The man holding Brandy had managed to tie the gag. He shoved her into Hazel's arms.
You take her, and bring her along.
She held Brandy to her, trying to comfort the child. Stassi clung to one leg and Paolo to the other. Stinky carried Driss. The raiders pushed her along, back up toward the bridge. The first thing Hazel saw coming into the bridge was her dad's body in a pool of blood. She almost dropped Brandy, but the child clung to her, legs and arms fastened tight. There were other bodies, all people she knew. Barris the navigator, and Sig the cargo chief, and Stinky's mother, gagged and bound, but glaring furiously. All the women of the crew, she noted, were lying there in a row, bound and gagged. Captain Lund faced the bridge access, bound to his command seat, and all the armed men wearing the same uniform as the ones who had captured her. The leader turned to Captain Lund.
You lied to us, Captain. That wasn't very smart.
I wanted to save the children.
The leader smiled, a smile that made Hazel feel cold inside.
God saves the children by giving them to those who will bring them up in righteousness.
Captain Lund looked at Hazel, then at Stinky.
I'm sorry.
The leader slammed his weapon into Captain Lund's head.
You don't talk, old man. Nobody talks to our children but our family. and you're going to be really sorry that you lied.
He turned to his men.
Get going now. Let's check these heathen sluts out, see if any of them's worth bothering with.
Hazel lay in the compartment that had been the spare passenger cabin, trying to hug all the littles at once. Driss was still dozing, and she didn't know if that was the sedative or the lump on his head. Paolo wept silently. Stassi had her whole hand in her mouth, sucking furiously. Brandy was out cold. Hazel wanted to take the gag out of her mouth, but she was afraid of the man with the weapon who stood by the hatch. She was afraid of everything. She had to pretend not to be, because the littles needed her. She was the one person they knew, the one person who could make them feel safe, if anything could, after what they'd been through. How could you make someone feel safe if you didn't feel safe yourself? She still could not believe it was all real. The soreness in her own body was real, and the hunger, and the fear, but had she really seen all she remembered? The women who had been her aunts, her mentors, since her own mother died, all... She didn't even know the words for what had been done to them, except the killing at the end. And even poor Captain Lund. She had known him since she could remember. A gentle man, a kind man. And they had stuffed his mouth with the tongues of the women and then shot him at the last. Hazel stroked a child's back.
Easy.
She wouldn't think about it anymore. She would think only of the littles who needed her.
These are the rules.
Hazel sat on the deck with Brandy in her lap and the others nestled against her.
Look at me.
Hazel had been looking at the littles because she'd been slapped already for looking. Staring, the man had said, at one of the raiders. Now she looked up, her shoulders hunching.
That's right. You look when I tell you to, where I tell you to. Now listen, these are the rules. You don't look at our faces unless you're told to. You don't talk. You, girlie, you can whisper to the babies if you have to, but only if none of us is talking. You keep the babies clean and fed. You keep the compartment and all the rest clean. You do whatever you're told. No talking, no arguing, nothing. If you want to keep your tongue in your head.
The grown women hadn't believed that, at least not at first. And they had died. She had to keep her tongue to comfort the littles. The man leaned close.
Now, what do you say?
Hazel was too scared to answer. He'd just told her not to talk. He grabbed her hair and yanked her head back.
I'll tell you what you say, girlie. Nothing. You bow your head when you're told what to do, and you say nothing. Women are not to speak before men. Women are to be obedient in silence. You understand?
Trapped, terrified, she tried to nod against the pull of his hand on her hair. He let go suddenly, and her head bobbed forward.
That's right. Bow your head in respect, in obedience.
He straightened up and took a step backward. Hazel watched his boots.
Now, you get busy, girlie. Get these brats cleaned up.
She needed clothes for them. She needed cleaning supplies. She wanted to ask, and she wasn't supposed to talk.
One of us will bring you what you need. Food and water, as long as you're obedient. Decent clothes for the babies. There's nothing on this heathen ship fit for you to wear. You'll have to make something. We'll show you pictures. You got the sink and toilet in there. You'll wash your clothes in that.
She wondered why, when the crew laundry would return the dirtiest clothes, clean, dry, and unwrinkled, in only a few minutes. She didn't ask. The supplies came a short time afterwards. Packets of food, powdered milk to mix with the water in the bathroom, sheets and towels, and a sack of children's clothes, soap and shampoo, combs and brushes. Even a few toys. Two dolls, blocks, a toy ground car. Hazel was grateful. She handed each of the littles a sweet bar and rummaged through the sack of clothes. There was Paolo's tan jumpsuit, Brandy's striped shirt, Stassi's flowered one, Driss's gray jumpsuit. But none of the girls' jumpsuits, nor the shorts they wore with shirts. The littles were so dirty, she couldn't tell which were smudges and which were bruises. As they finished their sweet bars, she herded them into the bathroom and used the towels and soap to clean them up. Then she got them all dressed, as much as possible, and folded the rest of the clothes. 4 more shirts, 4 more jumpsuits. 3 sets for each child, if only they'd been complete. And for herself, nothing but a long-sleeved pullover that was really Stinky's. It had been in her compartment because she'd traded shirts with him this last segment. She didn't put it on because she had nothing to wear with it. The thought of wearing that on her top and nothing below was worse than nothing at all. She stacked the clothes neatly in one corner and put the food in another. She let the children sort through the toys. Brandy chose blocks, as always. Stassi hugged her doll to her chest fiercely. Paolo began handing blocks to Brandy, while Driss put the other doll in the ground car and rolled it along the floor. Startled, Hazel almost looked up but remembered in time. The littles did look up, but quickly glanced away, toward her.
"Why aren't you dressed, girlie?"
She must not speak. She didn't know how to answer without speaking. She shook her head, spread her hands. The boots moved closer. The big hands tossed aside the neat stack she'd made of the clothes and came up with Stinky's pullover. The man threw it at her.
"Put this on, girlie. Now."
She fumbled her way into it.
"You wrap yourself in one of them sheets."
Hazel hadn't thought of that. She scrambled across the deck, grabbed a sheet, and wrapped it clumsily around her body, unsure of how to make it stay. Something landed on the deck in front of her. A small canvas bag.
"That's a sewing kit. If you can't sew, better learn. Make yourself something decent from the sheets. Cover your arms, everything to the ankles. Don't make the skirt too full. Only decent married women wear full skirts. Make them girl babies skirts, too. Sew them to their shirts."
He walked around, stood over the littles.
"What's this?"
Hazel didn't look up, didn't answer.
"Now, girlie, you got to teach these babies right. Girls play with girls. Boys play with boys. Girls got dolls. Boys got boys' toys. You keep them separate, you hear?"
But Brandy and Paolo were friends. They'd played together since infancy. And Brandy always played with blocks and building toys. Hazel crouched, scared and furious both, as the man knocked down Brandy's block tower and moved her near her sister.
"You, take this doll."
Brandy took it, but Hazel could see the anger in her eyes, almost enough to overcome the fear. Paolo, left with the scattered blocks, had already picked one up and was reaching toward Brandy.
"No! No blocks for girls, blocks for boys!"
Paolo looked puzzled. Casually, the man slapped Brandy against the bulkhead.
"Shut up! You better learn now, sissy!"